host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy Sean Shapiro. Sean, what's going on, man?
Not too much, man. I'm in the I'm recording from the lounge at Little Caesars Arena, one of our favorite places to do this show. And as you can maybe hear in the background, there's a little more noise than usual. It's Tigers opening day, or I guess home opener or whatever today, at the same time as Wings game here tonight. So a little more energy around me right now as opposed to our normal quiet stuff. But I'm good and I'm happy to be here.
I'm going to treat that as a studio audience, and the fact that the PDOcast is blowing up and we've got people now sitting in on these episodes that you and I record. I'm feeling 100% a little banged up myself, as you might be able to tell from my voice, but the show goes on. And the good thing is, you know, because we've had such a strong regular season here on the PDOcast, we've already had the good fortune of locking up our playoff spot, so we can use these last couple weeks of the regular season to iron some stuff out, to get into peak shape for the postseason and to be ready for game one of the playoffs. So that's what we're doing here today. But I thought it'd be fun to have you on to kind of take stock of where things are currently at in the East, but also bounce around a variety of random topics that you've been writing about recently that I've had this, whatever, 10 days or so off now. And generally the way my brain works is I use that time instead of actually stepping away from hockey and relaxing and recovering. I'm like mulling over like, the Tampa Bay Lightning, are they good again? I'm bouncing around all these different topics in my head. So we're going to get into some of those things that have been on my mind while I've been off. Let's start with the Eastern Conference wildcard race, though. We've got this battle for the two remaining playoff spots, right? The third seed in the Metro, the second wildcard spot. There's a big grouping of teams all of a sudden now that are jockeying for it, with the Penguins becoming the latest entrant into it. I guess I'm curious for your take on how excited you are kind of following this, because obviously one of the teams involved in it is the one whose lounge you're recording from right now, who you watch live and follow very closely. So there's certainly some personal interest in that regard, but just kind of seeing how this is playing out, because while the drama is certainly there, right, and this is what we really like in sports, it's like, all right, we're coming to the end of this 82 game regular season. These games still matter. These teams are still competing. There's still a lot on the line. I wouldn't also say that, you know, the quality of some of these games and the teams involved is particularly great. And certainly in some of these cases, it's like kind of a rock fight to the finish line here. So how are we kind of viewing this, and how are you feeling about sort of all of these festivities that are unfolding here in the final couple of weeks?
Hey, it's fun. I think it's more fun for us watching than it is for the coaches involved, because all of them are effectively in this spot because everyone else keeps losing it at various times. So like normally we've had good playoff races before, right? But normally it's like the rising tide lifts all ships type deal, where like two teams push each other and they're both going, and you're like, this is the opposite, where it seems like each team decides to take the turn to take a skid and everything like that. It's like, it's amazing to think, I looked this up earlier this week, where, so since we've gone to the wild card format, only the 2015-16 Minnesota Wild reached the playoffs with less than 90 points in a full season, obviously not counting kind of some truncated COVID asterisks. We're at a spot in the East, right, where we could legitimately have two teams in the postseason with under 90 points. And that's historical. That is historical for this time. And it's at times it's fun. I think there's a level to it that as we kind of like, it feels like the playoffs have already started, right? It's very cliche to say that, but right now almost you watch, and there's games every night that matter, right? You're watching the Wings play, watching the Red Wings will play tonight. Obviously for them, it's kind of must win, and not must win or whatever. It's been proven that must wins don't exist yet since everyone loses. But games, what happens last night in the Islanders Bill Jackets game, and then with the Penguins pushing and everything like that, all of a sudden all these games start to hold more meaning. And I think it gives us a lot to build on going in. And there's more teams, and it makes up for where the West is right now. Like, we know the eight teams in the West. Like, the East is, it's kind of fun right now to actually have a playoff. It's an actual battle. Like, there's it's not just two teams, it's four teams. It's actually fun.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think the incentive is certainly there, of course, and that's what we care about. I think the theory of it certainly checks out, right? Like, especially you look at the schedule in the final 2 weeks, and in particular, the final couple of days, we're going to get some really big games there, right? Where it's like, there's going to be legitimate playoff spots on the line where in these head-to-heads, and the winner might at that point secure their spot. And so that's incredibly cool. But then you also get into the position where, like, I'm watching that Capitals Penguins game on Thursday night, and you know, with the caveat that I was sitting on my couch watching every single second of it from start to finish, I wouldn't necessarily say like the quality of play was particularly amazing, right? Like the Penguins get two shots in the first, whatever, 15 minutes of the game. They're both point shots that are very harmless and somehow go in. And I'm sure the Hurricanes are watching that and they're like, see, it does work. And then it's like, all right, the Capitals now have to score two goals and watch them try to muster any sort of consistent offense is very painful and has been all year. And so actually watching these teams, it'll be obviously much more, the superior alternative would be these teams actually being very good and these being like very consequential games that are being played at a really high level, but I guess we can't have it all. So in that sense, I think it is enjoyable. And certainly like the Penguins getting into this, right? Like I think you can appreciate this sort of concept of they were left for dead. They trade Jake Ensel at the deadline, and particularly mid-February, they had this stretch where they scored like one goal in four games and just looked completely miserable. And then all of a sudden, they rattle off these three wins on the road against the Capitals, the Devils, the Rangers. Sidney Crosby's producing and sort of dragging this team back into the conversation. And so at least from like that perspective, I think that's cool. And that's certainly like a storyline that we can kind of get behind that sort of gives us a nice little appetizer at least for the playoffs. Because I think everyone would generally sort of agree that while anything can happen in the postseason, I think the reality of the one seed getting to play any of these teams who wins a second wild card is going to be a very lopsided series, at least on paper. And so I don't think there's a lot of consequence from like a whoever wins this can go on a long run necessarily like there was with last year's Panthers team. But at the same time, it gives us a bit of that playoff element during these days where otherwise, like in the Western Conference, there isn't necessarily that much to play for.
Yeah, I do hope that in teams, like it's funny this morning, I was left a morning skate, right, where I talked to the Wings, who are in a spot where it's, I basically have to win, and talk to the Rangers. They're playing the Rangers, who are basically kind of jockeying potentially the Stars for the President's Trophy. And I'm hoping that it's the type of thing that you hope for organically leads to everyone has something to play for at some level, where it's like, oh, we're playing for home ice, we're playing for a division, we're playing for this. And I think that's really good. I also think if that actually plays out true, it's actually really bad news for whenever team gets into, like, because whoever's going to, like, Detroit, New York right now, right? This, in theory, could be a first-round matchup. This could be the matchup if the Rangers, if Detroit is gets in and New York wins the East, which seems highly, which seems possible right now. I think for these teams that are kind of slumping at the time, these good teams seem to be kind of rearing up, and what happened to Boston last year against Florida kind of was that warning shot for everyone. So it's great that these teams are battling to get in, but it's also funny to kind of think about what could be waiting for them. It's not going to be anyone taking anything lightly is when these games actually become really real for those good teams.
Well, also none of these teams, let's be clear.
Yeah.
Like, none
oh,
of these
yeah,
teams
yeah,
the
yes,
profile
no, no,
of last
no.
year's Panthers team, where you could certainly see, and this isn't revisionist or hindsight, like you could see that while they had flaws, they also had a lot of things that could give teams trouble.
Yes,
in this case, it's a bunch of very flawed teams that are sort of throwing pebbles at each other and seeing who can stay up the longest, essentially. The Wings are an interesting spot, right? Because obviously they have so much on the line here, just because while they didn't necessarily do that much at the deadline, it's been so long since they've been in this position. And you've heard a lot of people within the organization talking recently about like how much of a nice sort of perspective change it is that these games actually matter at this point of the season, and they haven't in a long time. Now, they only have access to one of these two available playoff spots, right? Because like they obviously can't get the third seed in the Metro, regardless of what happens with those teams. But they also, compared to a team like the Penguins, who, while they're playing head-to-head against a bunch of these teams they're trying to leapfrog, they also, you look at their other games, and they're all against like very, very good teams. In the Red Wings' case, it's about as good as you could hope for from like a softness perspective, where they literally end the season with a back-to-back against the Canadiens. Now, if you're a team like the Red Wings, you can't take anything for granted, certainly, and we've seen them in the past kind of fumble these games. But they are also set up in a pretty good spot to sort of take advantage of this, and so I'm curious to see how all that plays out.
Yeah, it's funny, because this is the spot where Detroit coming into this season? Like, if you had said before the start of the season, hey, you'd be in this spot to control your own destiny a bit, you'd been happy. But it's also a weird feeling at the same time, because they shouldn't have been in this spot. They shouldn't, after what happened and where they were, kind of the fall to have to actually be in this battle, after being at one point they were 10 points, they were closer to being on top of the division than being out of the playoffs at one point. And so the fact that they are here, it's this whole Detroit thing, it puts more the weight of whether they get in or not, I think, now is now going to reflect more on how people outside of the Wings view this team and Steve Yzerman and Derek Lalonde than you would have thought before this season. Before this season, whether the Wings made or missed the playoffs, it would have been either way, oh, we still soldier on, the plan's still there. With where they went and then how they stumbled, and now if they don't get in, it starts to feel almost like a failure, which is, I'm not sure if that's fair or not, but I think that's the other thing that's fascinating about this Detroit team. And I think there's the pressure and the weight of that is really hanging on this team. They like to say it's fun right now, but at the same time, it's also not fun when you feel like if they don't get in after where they were, it starts to be like, okay, what's actually happening with this plan and this rebuild right now? And that's just the reality of how expectations change from month to month sometimes.
Well, I will say, watching that most recent, their most recent game was against the Lightning, right? On the road.
Yeah.
It felt like it really could have gone south there. And in particular, they come away, they steal that game at the end of regulation. But just watching it, I've been so, I'm not sure if you agree with this, I've been so impressed with watching Lucas Raymond play here as this season has developed, right? And the scoring is kind of modest, especially in the context of today's game, where players are just putting out such ridiculous video game totals that we're all getting like desensitized to it, right? Like, for you to be very impressed with a player's goal or point total, they just have to be doing something so preposterous. And a guy like Lucas Raymond is not, especially at this point of his career, given his circumstances, ever going to come close to that. But just what he's doing in terms of like how much he's creating, and there's still stuff certainly being left on the table, and there's been a bunch of opportunities where he's made a couple nice moves and then he either passed up instead of shooting, or the puck just didn't go in and he didn't get credit for it. But just watching how much he created in a game like that, I think that has to be encouraging. And there's going to be no silver linings. I think you hit the nail on the head there, where the context of how you get to this point matters, because if this team had been out of it and then putting together a feverish run down the stretch here and winning a bunch of games and fighting their way back into it, we'd view it as a positive even if they missed it. But just because of the state of the East and where they were at a couple weeks ago, it'll be viewed as a massive disappointment if they don't get in. I just think the play of him in particular, so much has been made of Mo Sider, and you and I have certainly spent a full show talking about his usage and deployment and how he's fared in that. I think what we've seen from Raymond in a situation where he's being asked with JT Compher to shoulder a second line here, right? Like, this isn't a matter of him sort of running shotgun in a favorable situation with a Dylan Larkin or with an Alex DeBrincat. He's doing a lot of this heavy lifting offensively himself. And just the fact that he's putting that on tape right now in a big offseason for him, where he's going to get a big contract, this is a crossroads moment for both him and the Red Wings. I think that's a very important thing here, regardless of what happens within the team context.
And it's one of those stories too that kind of got a little bit lost, I think, in the national Red Wings storytelling because of the Patrick Kane signing, for right or wrong, right? Like, it's, I don't think Kane's addition actually made life easier for Raymond at all. Like, sometimes, like, I don't think that's fair at all, but I think it did kind of, it has overshadowed what he's doing when it comes to the narrative. Because so far, so much of the talk about the Red Wings, so much is, especially when you talk about wingers, it's going to come back to Kane, it's going to come back to DeBrincat. And it's just kind of been one of those stories that is a reality, as you laid out. But I don't think we've talked about it enough. And it's going to lead to a fascinating contract situation, because it's one of those deals where I think we're going to see how it plays out is going to be really interesting, just because there's going to be a couple different schools of thought, and that could be a whole other episode you and I do at some point, because he's a fascinating player in that realm.
Well, I think we spoke about this a little bit with the Sider conversation, actually, in terms of like the involvement of the agent and kind of like how you could frame the case for your client in that negotiation. Mm-hmm. But like, this is one where in particular, like, there's some where you're kind of in a tricky spot where you're obviously going to do your best to get your client as much as you possibly can, right? And there's certain ways where you could like fudge the numbers and move stuff around to make it look better than it actually is. In this case, I think there's like a very strong argument for Raymond to be worth much more than he probably is going to get based on just that production, right? And in particular, like he seems like a player who, just based on all of the little stuff we've seen and what he's put on tape so far, I would bet on him exploding offensively much more, that being a much more likely outcome over the next couple of years, and him commanding significantly more money and attention than what he's getting right now. And so you get into that sort of balance of like long-term security and sort of securing the bag while you can, versus also this idea that it's like, all right, your leverage a couple of years from now is going to be significantly stronger if you sort of bet on yourself and believe that that's all going to come together for you.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm in the Wings camp, I'm trying to get a long-term deal done now with Raymond. That's where you're trying to get long-term done now, because it's going to cost you more in the long run. Otherwise, that's the reality for me. And if I'm in Raymond's camp, I'm looking at, can I get the, we know Steve Yzerman has tried to do, now those have been more with UFAs than RFAs. Like we saw him sign the DeBrincat deal to a shorter, as opposed to the typical like DeBrincat thing. You'd think like, oh, you bring a guy in, you sign him for 8 years. I guess, sorry, technically DeBrincat was an RFA, but he came in from outside. But so we've seen Yzerman do these shorter deals and everything like that. And honestly, if I'm Raymond, maybe that's where I kind of push for it. It's like, I want something like that because I know I'm going to set up that next contract extremely well if I pop off the way you said. But if I'm Detroit with him, I want to get that long-term deal done, because otherwise it's going to hurt me as I got to get some other guys signed too as we go into the future too.
Yeah. Do you have any other notes on any of these teams? Because so much is going to change with every single day, right? Based on the way these teams play, they're so close to each other. I guess in thinking about this, it's just like, what a missed opportunity it has to feel like, not to rub salt on the wound, but like for teams like the Devils and Sabres, where they came into the season with such high expectations, right? Based on what they showed us last year. And the fact that it's opened up like this, and I think all of these teams ahead of them are so flawed and have so many weaknesses. And you're seeing it where every time we think one of them is going to distance themselves or really lock down one of these spots, they lose three out of four games, or they just completely fall flat on their face. And for them to not be able to be ahead of these teams in the standings, I think that's going to be a really difficult pill to swallow as we get into the offseason and sort of think about what's next for them moving forward.
Well, it's like when you and I did our last mailbag show, we talked about which teams were most disappointing or whatever. There's options given out. And I was pretty adamant that it's New Jersey, and it's their lack of willingness to get a goalie earlier probably cost them. That's a team that should be a playoff team right now. And it's going to be a sour summer for them when you think about that, because they had this opportunity and they squandered it.
They really have. I guess my one final note here before we go to break is I referenced the Lightning at the top, and it seemed like for a while there, like I think before the Red Wings went on that skid themselves and Larkin got hurt, they were like neck and neck, right? If anything, the Lightning were in danger of being one of these teams in this conversation. And since the deadline, it was kind of a bit of a relatively like innocuous move, because it was like a third for a seventh or something. And we've seen Anthony Duclair bounce around a bunch of teams, but the addition of him has made such a big difference for them watching them. And I can't stop thinking about it, because earlier on this season, I wrote this Lightning team off completely. I have to admit, just because they look completely cooked to me, right? I was like, Kucherov is having an unbelievable MVP caliber season. Their power play is obviously always going to make you concerned in any given game or potential series setting, but they're so flawed 5-on-5 defensively. They're so slow. And now not only has Duclair given them some of that like individual skating speed, but he's also allowed John Cooper to play Brandon Hagel full time with Cirelli and Stamkos. And that's unlocked Stamkos a bit offensively at 5-on-5. It's given them a bit more depth. And now all of a sudden, everything's coming together. Like you're seeing Darren Radish playing with Victor Hedman, and they're playing really well together. The team's defense as a whole, I know there's still a lot of questions about the foot speed on the back end and like the actual talent in terms of the players themselves, but the metrics defensively have all significantly improved. They've been in the top 10 for a while now, and this team's just much better than I thought they had any right to be like as recently as a month or two ago. And so I guess kudos to them because they've played their way out of this sort of caliber of team.
And kudos to Anthony Duclair too. I mean, he's a guy who, one of the things I think we need to keep in mind with Duclair on all of this stuff, I think he's a good player, and I've written about this before actually, is Duclair is his own agent. He's a guy who actually controls his own destiny completely on things. And so when he went to San Jose and decided to go there, it was fully on him to make that decision. There was no outside recourse pushing him one way or the other or figuring it out. So credit to Anthony Duclair too for, I'm sure it wasn't, I mean, when he signed with San Jose, he had to know obviously the vision of the plan for something there, but it's a team and a player who I think they found each other at the right time.
Well, no. So what happened was he was already under contract, right? Because Florida essentially had to move him because they were so tight up against it. So he signed that deal for himself with the Panthers.
Yes.
But it kind of flew under the radar because he hired an agent right before the deadline. And I'm not sure how much of that played into it, but it was really funny because...
That's true.
You could frame it as he fired himself to hire a different agent. And so,
that is true. That is true. That detail was one that I forgot there. So thank you for reminding me that. Yeah, that was... he did. Agents, teams, GMs are more receptive to actual agents calling you around the deadline as opposed to the player. Can you imagine the fly on the wall of like, hey, we're going to let you go work out a trade. And then just Anthony Duclair calling him, calling Julian Breezeball himself up of, I think I'm worth this. Send a this pick for me.
Just sending him clips of goals he scored the other night because no one was actually watching Sharks games. Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, Sean, let's take a break here, and then when we come back, we'll move on, and we'll talk about a variety of other topics. You're listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we are back here on the Hockey PDOcast, joined by Sean Shapiro. Sean, we talked part one. It was all Eastern Conference wildcard race. Let's get into a variety of other topics and kind of try to have some fun with it. I want to talk to you about, you saw the goal Kirill Marchenko scored last night. Certainly coming, you know, with increased prevalence. Every time I have Kevin Woodley on these days, we talk about it particularly from the goalie's perspective, which I think is almost just as interesting. These shots kind of either behind the net or around the goal line that are specifically targeting, banking it in off their helmet or off their shoulder from these tight angles. And I think the conversation around these shots is so interesting to me because whenever one of them happens, there's a certain segment of fans that are certainly like, wow, that was really cool. And then there's a bunch of other ones who are instantly complaining about goalie technique and how that was the reason it happened. And then there's fans who are looking at it and being like, all right, well, that was sort of, you know, disrespectful from the shooter's perspective, or like, oh man, like how mean of him to do that. And obviously part of it is kind of tongue in cheek, certainly, but I'm curious for your take on it, in particular from the goalie perspective, because I think you have an interesting anecdote about it.
Yeah, it's not, it's not disrespectful. It's, you're trying to score goals. It's a hockey game. The point of the game is to score goals. You should do whatever you can to score goals. But it is interesting because, so obviously this happens and Marchenko scores this goal the other night and I'm at the morning skate. I'm at the rink early this morning to try to beat traffic around the building because of that baseball game. And so I'm out there a little bit earlier and I can hear just see Alex Lyon and Alex and the Red Wings goalie coach Westland. They're on the ice or anyone else and they're on the net and they start talking about that play. And I don't hear the whole conversation completely, but essentially they were talking about, well, how Sorokin actually played that, how a goalie should play that. That is a credit to Marchenko that it worked, but at the same time, it's a good slice that A, these things get talked about like around the league. Like you think like, you and I talk about these things in Messenger at the same time. NHL coaches and goalies are probably looking at it today and breaking down, okay, what happened, even though it's not us. To me, the thing that's interesting about it is we see the highlight when it goes in, right? We see the highlight when it goes in. And you clipped it, right? It's great. It's a great clip to see. We're not clipping every single time a guy shoots from below the net and he misses a foot wide or it hits the side of the net. Like we're not going through and getting all that. It's a play that's working now, but it's not this like, oh, it works every single time type deal. And I think that's important. It's also, I laugh when people are like, oh, that's disrespectful or whatever, because It's a flaw. I'd say it's a chance to score goals. Scoring goals is hard. You should do it any way you can. And I think it's part of, and Woodley would probably give you a more eloquent answer on this, but if you're in the goalie spot on that, do I really want to duck my head back into the net and take away my view of that pass out? Like, how am I going to be able to telescope out to a shooter, to another shooter, if I'm stuck sticking my head deep into them? It's cool that Marchenko did it, but it's like, you got to treat it like a one-off as a goalie. And that's kind of one of my thoughts on this. We can hopefully I've said something of substance there.
No, you did. Well, first off, I think the real ones know that Kirill Marchenko is a stud. And yes. I think if you watch that whole sequence, like I only tweeted out the replay of it, he just expertly stick lifts Noah Dobson in the last second to actually gain possession of the puck. And then if you watch, like the replay is cool because you can actually sort of like see it play out. But I really recommend watching the real-time shot of it because how quickly he goes from receiving possession of it to instantly making the decision to fire and executing it, it happens within the blink of an eye, right? This isn't a matter of him just kind of hanging out behind the net like we sometimes see with Michigan's and then doing that as kind of a last resort. The reason why I brought up this idea of like it kind of being like embarrassing or whatever, and I think it clearly is embarrassing for goalies, right? Like you never want to have a guy from a bad angle bank it off of your helmet. Not only does that, I'm sure, kind of like it rattles you physically, but also like it doesn't look good, certainly. It's not showboaty, or it's not like it looks cool, but it's in a way it's like the most functional possible option from there if the passes are taken away, right? And this is kind of what we talk about a lot. I think it reflects a bit of a misunderstanding of the play in terms of what's happening, because I think Sorokin did play that right? Like there was certainly...
No, he did. 100%. He did.
There was space there to shoot, but in that span and from that position, like that, if anything, just reflects how talented Kirill Marchenko and how talented shooters in today's game are, that they can pick that spot that quickly and hit it, right? And there's certainly going to be times where he tries or someone tries and they miss and we don't talk about it. And that's all well and good. But if you watch it, when he goes behind the net, there's two Columbus Blue Jacket skaters who start cutting from the top of the zone down, right? Yeah. And the whole point of the reverse VH is to essentially protect the goalie from the most likely or imminent danger, which is either passes across the ice where he's going to have to move laterally and cut off down low, or out from behind the net for a tap-in that's probably going to go low as well, right? And so that's what the goalie is trying to stop. Now, the compensation for that, because you can't take away every single little square inch of the net, is that there's this one little window near your ear for a shooter to try and target. And sort of that cat and mouse game or that chess match that's happening between the shooter and the goalie is what we're seeing here. So it's the natural byproduct of that. Shooters are targeting it and executing much more frequently than they did previously. And I think the next domino to fall will be fascinating, and we're not going to necessarily see it in season, but I'm curious to see in the offseason or in years to come, particularly for young goalies on the way up, how much their technique changes in this regard, right? Because I think for a while, and you've written about this, we've talked about it, the goalie position has become so robotic, especially in comparison to their skater counterparts, where we're seeing so much more creativity and nuance with the way players are training and what they're trying to accomplish, whereas goalies went the other direction, where it was like, all right, this is the one technique that works. Everyone's going to play this way. Everyone is going to look the exact same, be the same size, and move the same way. And I don't think it's enough anymore to just be like positionally sound, to be like, all right, I'm going to block off this and I'm going to be good, because skaters are too good now at problem solving and they're going to work around that. So like now goalies, with the game being as fast as ever, are going to have to problem solve on the fly and be sort of accounting for the situational awareness, which is something they probably didn't need to worry about as much before. And so I'm not sure if the goalies in today's game, while they're all so athletically gifted, are necessarily wired to do so right now. It might be a next generation thing, but I'm curious to see what the sort of adjustment is from the goalies to compensate for this, and then what that opens up for shooters after that.
But I think one of the keys to problem solving is, I think the guys who are going to be the bona fide, quote unquote, number ones as things go and everything like that, they're going to be the guys who are willing to adjust and real and be athletes about this, right? Now, not the exact same type of season, but like one of the things that, and he actually said something about it in an interview on the Turner broadcast the other night. So we've, you and I've talked a lot about the Dallas Stars and Jake Ottinger. Jake Ottinger's year has not been nearly as good, but past five games, part of that is the Chris Tanev trade. Stars have been a better defensive team. Another thing that he did is, and I've spoken to people from the Stars about this, where one of the things the Stars did with Ottinger was they went, he and his goalie coach Jeffries went and looked at where he was playing in his crease. He started intentionally playing, and they kind of used an example going back to Lundqvist, because A, Ottinger was this huge Lundqvist fan. Ottinger's favorite goalie of all time was Lundqvist. So it was easy to use his hero as kind of the example in the video. But if you look at where Ottinger's feet are set in the crease, the last five games where they were for most of the season, he's much deeper in his crease. He's adjusted, like he's made a slight adjustment. Those are the type of examples that I think we don't call out enough when we look at how things go over the course of the season. I think part of it is also people don't always understand goaltending. I think we just assume it's a, we see a goalie, we don't really focus on what they're doing until they get the puck, until the puck comes at them. So this kind of, just like that conversation I witnessed with Lyon and Alex Westland, that is a perfect example of the goalies that are going to adjust. And probably right now, there's probably no in-season adjustment to dealing with trying to have someone try to bank it all the back of your head. But you go into the lab, you figure it out. It's going to be tested and figured out. I hope, just as someone who, A, likes goaltending and still attempts to play it myself, that this is a thing where goaltending gets better, because it's kind of silly when we like high-scoring games, we like goals, but I go and I watch some junior hockey games being right here in Michigan, and it's sad to watch just kids get like just ripped apart because they all try to do the exact same thing. And I hope that 3-4 years from now, you and I have a conversation. I'd be like, oh, I actually get to see good goaltending at an OHL game. I actually get to see good goaltending in a USHL game. And that's so rare for people now, just because it's a bunch of 16, 17-year-old robots. Once again, I keep losing my train of thought mid-talking to you, and I hope that I'm, this is why I need an editor. This is why I have JD handle all my stuff.
No, well, this is the beauty of the format of podcasting, right? We can just talk our way through our thoughts. I think at the intermission, Marchenko actually, and part of it is just he's a hilarious character, and like he really deserves more attention as being like a young star that people care about. And unfortunately, the Blue Jackets just have not warranted it in the 2 years he's been in the league. But I think that will come if he keeps this up and they hopefully turn things around. But he was asked sort of like, if he practices it, right? And he essentially said, no, because it's hard to get goalies to sit there and let me shoot it off their head. And
yes,
that's true. Like, I think in practice, you probably aren't trying to shoot the puck at your own goalie's head to try to score, because while I'm sure you do want to score and practice on stuff that you might use in a game, you also are a bit more cognizant of like their health and potentially just shooting pucks at their head, right? And so that, I think, is a testament to the fact that while you can sort of work on your shooting accuracy, a lot of this stuff does have to be freelanced in the game. And that's because these skaters from a young age now, with like all the development coaches and skills coaches they're working with and skating coaches and everything, they're being given the tools to not necessarily do this stuff in practice, but because they've cobbled together enough different skills, when they get into a game, they're comfortable trying stuff like this, right? And obviously the risk reward is much different for a goalie, where if you try something crazy and you're out of your net and you give up a goal against, you're going to look foolish. Everyone's going to be like, why did you do that? And it's going to be a whole different can of worms. So it's not the same as a guy like this shooting from behind the net, missing, and no one thinks twice about it, certainly. But at the same time, I just think goalies are not in a position right now to be trying stuff. And part of that is the limitations of the position, but part of it is also because of all this stuff that goes into it behind the scenes and during the summers, before we actually get into NHL season.
Well, it's also part of the quote-unquote YouTube generation of hockey now. It's great. Like, so there's going to be a bunch of, I'm sure there's a bunch of kids. There might be a couple AAA goalies across Canada and the United States today who are going to be pissed because of the, that someone's going to go, their own teammate's going to go behind the net and try to shoot it off the back of their head because he saw it in a Twitter highlight or a YouTube highlight the night before. And it is, goalies, though, anytime the clip comes out, it's man, the goalie's gone crazy. Like nothing from the goalie YouTube generation is something that a coach would say, yeah, go try that. For the players, it's, you can mess around, you can do that. You can try this here or there. And it's the same thing like with the Michigan stuff, right? Where every player can do it now because they've seen guys try it in games, and now, okay, I got an extra 5 minutes at the end of practice, I'm gonna do this. Goalies, you don't get to be, what are you gonna try? Are you gonna try to stick handle yourself a bit? There's nothing you can try as a goalie kind of in that time. You could stretch more, you can work on your skating, but there's nothing sexy about that time where you can try to create something new in 5 minutes of practice or something like that.
Well, I guess part of it is also the job requirements or kind of what you're trying to accomplish, right? Where I'm sure the goalies and part of the members of the goalie union who are listening to this will not agree, but you're generally trying to like remove fun, right? And like that's the goalie's main job, is to prevent fun stuff from happening. Like,
yeah, you're trying to prevent fun stuff for the other team. Okay, I'll put it that way. As a member of said goalie union, you're trying to remove fun stuff for the other team.
No, but also I think also from your own perspective, where I think like someone who knows the goaltending position would always agree with the fact that one of these highlight reel saves where you're diving across and making an acrobatic save is something you don't want to depend upon, because it's kind of a reflection of you potentially being out of position or chasing the play. Whereas if you're in the right position and the puck just hits you squarely in the chest and you control the rebound, that's like a nothing save that no one's ever going to think back to. But a goalie purist would be like, yeah, that was the right play right there, right? And so that's kind of the opposite of what's happening with skaters. Now, I do also, like, the reason why I wanted to note that, though, is because I know what you mean, but sometimes I think purists can sort of, like, bemoan the fact that all of these, like, trick plays and this YouTube generation is going away from the stuff that used to work back in the day. But this is, like, this, I guarantee you, this is the most functional in today's climate until goalies adjust. This is the right play to do. Like, I think it's much more likely to go in than trying to wrap it around with the puck on the ice and trying to jam it in. That's not going to score very often against today's goalies. This actually has a chance of becoming a goal beyond just looking cool. So I think it's very fascinating. Do you have any other notes on this, or do you want to talk a little bit about Roman Josi?
Yeah, let's talk Josi.
Okay, so you wrote a fascinating piece about him. You've written about the Predators this season. We've spoken a bunch about them. During this run Nashville's on, and it's 22 games now, their point streak ended, but they had a very fun win against St. Louis on Thursday. It's 22 games now. In that time since they turned their season around, Roman Josi has 9 goals, 19 assists, 14 of which are primary. I think Quinn Hughes has had the Norris Trophy locked up for a while now, but I think this stretch of games for Roman Josi has worked his way and warranted him to be in that conversation for finalists beyond Quinn Hughes. And I think he's been phenomenal. He's been a big reason for this. But much more interesting to me than that is sort of the adjustments that he's had to make in concert with the adjustments the team has made under Andrew Brunette this season, and kind of how moving away from kind of like, or moving towards, I guess, a less is more approach for him has actually improved everyone's efficiency. And I think that's so interesting because he's a player who certainly had success previously, but did so in a way where it was very, like the NBA term, heliocentric, right? Where like everything had to revolve around him. He did so much of the heavy lifting with the puck on a stick. And now he's still got 20 goals this season as a defenseman, which is great, but he's doing it in a much different way than he did previously.
Yeah, and Andrew Brunette told me this, and then you go and you look at it, look at the numbers on it too, and you watch Josi. Oh, like he's gone from a lot of the, well, I'm typically taking a puck and I'm lugging it from the defensive zone through. I'm taking that neutral zone transition success depends on the puck staying on my stick. And that's kind of used to be a lot of the Roman Josi mentality on it. And now it's become more and more of I am both a, to use it, steal an NFL term, he's become more and more of the run pass option guy, where it's more give and goes. It's more taking space as given and then finding the pass and then getting the puck back. And the Predators in general, if you watch, and I did this when I was looking on that story, if you go and you watch Josi, it's fascinating to see he may not have the puck as much, but he's manipulating space more. He's doing all of those little things. It's very, and I'm a big soccer guy, as people know, it's very, to me, it's very similar to a great central midfielder whose job is not necessarily to dribble the ball down the field, but to make those 1-2s, to make those slight space manipulations so others can get going. And that's what Yossi's kind of become more so this year. He's always a great defender, but to me, that's just taking a next step in his game. And frankly, it probably took about half the season for him to really feel comfortable fully embracing that role too, with Brunette changing their system.
Well, I think what it highlights is, and I think it makes sense, but just seeing it kind of reinforce here, is the puck travels faster than any player can skate, right?
Yes, and yes, yes.
So much of today's game, and it's kind of this fascination for us of like optimizing the efficiency of offense and finding ways to create, is predicated on attacking the opposition before they can get set defensively, right? You wouldn't necessarily know it by like all the individual point totals, and you look at the Art Ross race right now, and generally the goal scoring around the league, but teams have gotten really good defensively because I think there's a gained appreciation now for what works and what doesn't when you see a team like Vegas have the success they had, and the ability to kind of like, all right, we're going to give you shots from anywhere in terms of these in-zone situations, but we're going to protect the slot. And it's easier said than done, but I think every team, and the good ones in particular, go into games now with that as their game plan, right? And like, that's how we're going to try to give you problems and slow you down offensively. So the way to work around that is to attack off the rush and quickly off of broken plays and transition before they can get set. And so for a player like Yossi now, instead of having to go back, retrieve the puck, allow the forecheck and defense to get set, and then kind of weave his way through and then have to create in the offensive zone, he's quickly passing the puck up the ice and then skating without it. And what that's allowing as well is for him to kind of get lost a little bit more now in the traffic, right? Because I think when a guy like him, he's such a dazzling skater, but when he has the puck, it's very easy to have your defensive assignment on him, right? Like, everyone knows where the puck is. You're tracking him every step of the way, and it's tough for him to get lost in coverage. In this sense, when he passes the puck up, all of a sudden now he can sort of weave around and get open and get the puck in more advantageous scoring positions. And so he's doing a bit less himself, and his puck touches might be down, but it's almost impossible to argue that he's getting more out of his game because each of those puck touches now are more efficient and in more dangerous areas of the ice. And I think that's really cool the way him and Andrew Brunette have worked together to sort of get that out of him at this point of his career.
Yeah. It's the other thing about, you watch Yossi too, and all of that, and you kind of sums it up perfectly. The other thing that he's done really well, and he always did it before, but it's something that actually didn't end up in that story, but I remember Brunette, one of those things Brunette told me to kind of watch for when I watched Yossi play when I last talked to him, was Yossi has taken, giving that free time and space now without lugging the puck, Yossi scans more. And that's, I don't know if there's a way to quantify it or whatever, but it was something Andrew Brunette told me to kind of look for when I watch Yossi. And he said, he says, like, Yossi scans more. He's when he doesn't have the puck, he's now looking at all these options, and he's finding other routes and other ways to get to space that he probably was frankly ignoring before, just because of the, well, you have to lug the puck or you have to do this. That's a thing too that wasn't in that story, but just to kind of add to your point there, you watch Yossi play, just look at how he scans the ice now. It's at a higher rate. I have no way to quantify it, but it's at a higher rate according to his coach than it was before.
Well, and I think one of the added perks of this is like, he's going to be 34 in June, which sounds crazy to say, right?
Yeah.
Because he still looks so young, and it still feels like he's still young, and certainly his production is like very prime level. But he's going to be 34, and I think like the sustainability of playing into your mid-30s at this level is much more likely in this way, where you're just having to do a bit less. I think there's less of a physical toll as well, right? Where I think the shifts you take are much more onerous when you have the puck and you're taking a bunch of physical contact and you're having to do a lot more with it, as opposed to kind of skating more freely and then picking your spots the way he has. I think it makes much more sense that this is going to elongate his prime, whatever that is, for the next couple of years as well, right? And that's something we certainly, is kind of more theoretical, I guess, and we'll see how that plays out over the next couple of years. But beyond just the value it's provided this year, I think as like an investment in the player and him being the team's captain and his importance to the franchise, it makes sense that I think this is going to be able to stretch that out and ensure that he's playing at this level when he's 36, 37 as well, which I think is kind of cool.
I mean, what's your best? I mean, just from a black and white business perspective too, you sign a guy to a big contract. If you want to maximize the value of that contract, you want to maximize his play as a player. And that's what this does.
Yeah, he's been phenomenal. I mean, during that 22-game stretch I referenced, he's been on the ice for 51 of Nashville's 88 goals. At 515, they're up 32 to 16 in his minutes, and he's got high danger chance shares and expected goal shares comfortably in the 60s. So this is very legit, and he's doing so in a very sustainable way, so it's really cool to see. Any other notes on Josi here, or do you want to do our sign-out here? Because I know you have a...
Let's do our sign-out, yeah.
But Daniel Sprong... anecdote as well. It's in the ground reporting. PDOcast listeners are always down for more Daniel.
I mean, this is talking to Daniel Sprong today after he and I chatted about this. I felt I had to tell this story here because I know the big Daniel Sprong fans we have here. So Daniel Sprong is Dutch and Canadian descent. He was born in the Netherlands, but grew up playing hockey in Canada. And so I was today in kind of the locker room. I was curious to kind of get the firsthand story. If I asked Daniel Sprong if he ever considered playing internationally for his birth country, and he told me that if the Netherlands ever reached the kind of the spot where they were potentially playing to qualify for the Olympics, he definitely would. But the problem is right now the Dutch National Hockey Federation doesn't have enough money doesn't have the right finance, he put it, to have the insurance to cover him playing for them. And he was worried about the lose-lose nature of potentially playing in the Division B World Championship, or whatever the technical terminology is, where he believes in his heart of hearts he could carry the Dutch team to at least the championship game of that level. But he said, you score a lot of goals in there, or whatever, you're going to be either ripped on for doing too well or not well enough. So he did also say there's other players. He did leave this one thing open. Daniel Sprong said that if he knows there's some other players that have slight Dutch nationality and would potentially could get Dutch passports. And so a couple of them were to come together and decide that they would all come together, maybe later in his career, they would form the Dutch super team. So that is the Daniel Sprong Dutch national team story I got today for you.
Well, I thought your story was going to be like, all right, he's looking at these broadcasts that are talking about Canada's roster, and he's like, all right, is Crosby or McDavid bumping to the wing? And if so, which guy am I playing with? Who's feeding me the pucks? And I thought that's where his mind would be at. But no, that's interesting. I've got actually, I was at a dinner party recently, and my partner has family friends who are from the Netherlands. And then they were obviously, you know, he comes up what I do for work, and we're talking about hockey and stuff. And they're like, oh, yeah, like, you know, hockey's not that big in the Netherlands. And I was like, oh, well, you must not be familiar with Dutch Gretzky, Dale Weiss, and his historic run in the league over there. So they were like, no, we actually are not familiar with that. And I was like, all right, well, I mean, very few are, but maybe just because of the local connections here, I was that was something I was keeping very close tabs on.
I thought this was going to be a story where you were going to say someone was just like, oh, have you ever heard of Daniel Sprong? And then your poor partner all of a sudden was now subject to the entire night of talking about shooting locations and the confidence to shoot from everywhere over dinner and perhaps a lack of defensive zone coverage.
I guarantee you that has happened at various points. Not in this particular occasion, but Daniel Sprong has come up. Yes. Sean, this was great. I'm glad we got to touch base and talk about a bunch of stuff. I'll let you plug some stuff here at the way out. Let the listeners know either what you're working on or what they can look forward to from you moving forward.
Yeah, for coming tomorrow, I got my weekly column over at EP Ringside. Got something with the nature of the President's Trophy race with both the Rangers and the Stars. I've got that coming at Ringside tomorrow. Check that out. I just dropped something over at my site looking at face-offs and the fact how... we've got more players than ever. It's not a new thing, but we got more players than ever who are maybe a righty taking the face off as a lefty on their weak side and flipping the stick over. And talked to Vincent Trocheck about it this morning, who doesn't more than most in the NHL, and the Rangers are a team, from my recollection and from my research on it, the first kind of team that's actually done it as a on a whole team base, as opposed to seeing one guy or a couple guys. The Rangers have pretty much all four centers do this, where they go that. So I've got that over at the Substack, over at Shapshots, and as I've been plugging and pitching, we made a beer league hockey movie. It's The Late Game. Go to thelategame.com and you can stream it there. So
it turns out everyone's really got their limits, right? Because I think I'm in the top percentile of like my interest in random niche hockey stuff and my knowledge on it. But you were DMing me about Austin Zarnik's face-off technique, and I was like, I got to be honest, Sean, even for me, this is going too far. And I got out of this conversation.
I had last night, so I'm working on it last night, and I'm trying to visualize this last night. This is how my ridiculous, dumb, beautiful brain works. I get the one kid to bed. My wife's getting the other kid to bed. She comes downstairs. On the computer, I've got random face-off stats. I'm in the kitchen, and I have grabbed a right-handed hockey stick from the garage, and I'm holding it left-handed, trying to visualize how this works. And my wife just walks downstairs into the kitchen and just shakes her head and turns around. She's like, this is how my brain goes down some random paths. So that's your wagon rolling by at the live studio audience, the PDO cast right now. So.
And that's a good time for us to sign out here, Sean. I'm going to let you go. Thanks for coming on. Thank you to the listeners for joining us for the ride. It's good to be back at it, but we're not done just yet. I'm going to let Sean go here. But we're going to come back for one more episode of the Hockey PDO cast to close out the week here on the Sportsnet Radio Network.